And we are, as a people, inherently and historically
wake
opposed
up.
To secret societies, the secret oath, and the secret proceedings.
The show that asks questions about why we don't ask questions.
What the hell is going on?
This is Conspiracy Queries with Alan Park. Welcome to Conspiracy Queries with Alan Park. I'm Alan Park. We've got some conspiracy queries. So you've obviously found the right station. We have a great guest today. His name is Grant Elder, and he's a writer. Well, he is now. He didn't intend to be, but some things happened in his life and things that he saw going on in the world around him, and it forced him to become a writer. And it's a very fascinating book that he has, indeed. It's called Wiki versus NWO. And he will explain what all of those things are. It's not Wikipedia. So if you're a Wikipedia hater, don't tune out. But it is the NWO, the New World Order. So he will be here shortly to discuss this. But first, an interesting article popped up on The Stack. Check that out, thestack.com. Really good stuff. And turns out our friend Ed Snowden, the information leaker, has some words of wisdom about Canada. Says, create unrest is Canada's CSC agency. That's like the NSA, but for Canada. Includes false flag operations as part of newly revealed cyber warfare scope. Wow, which is amazing because they were doing the cyber warfare during Operation Determined Dragon, which was going on under the military. Just last October when the shootings happened. So obviously their systems don't work very well or the shooter wouldn't have got away with it, right? So here it is on The Stack. Says, documents obtained from Edward Snowden reveal the extent of the cyber warfare techniques used by Canada's Communications Security Establishment Canada, CSEC, including the capacity and will to perform false flag operations, where responsibility for cyber attacks, counterattacks, or other intelligence-related activity is misattributed to individuals, groups, or nation-states. The Intercept, in collaboration with the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, that's weird, are they still around, has published limited details of CSEC's cyber warfare capabilities and disposition, just as Canada's Bill C-51, drafting anti-terrorism legislation currently under criticism from anyone that's sane, for its potential to silence legitimate protest, is under fierce debate in Canada's House of Commons. It's a bit of a laugh, the fierce debate, because what you got is you've got the Harpers, you know, trying to ram it through, you know, this bill that's remarkably similar to the other ones in the Five Eyes nations. And you've got the Liberals who are opposite them saying right away, yeah, sure, great, okay, great. And if we get into power, we'll change a couple of things because we wear different colored ties than you guys. And the NDP are fighting against it, so good for them, and I wish they'd use all the information available to them to be able to fight it. But they're doing the best they can, I suppose. Anyway, back to the article. The deception tactics outlined by the documents include false flag techniques. Okay, this is official documentation, so stop telling me this stuff doesn't happen, you dummies that keep saying it never happens. False flag techniques carried out in order to create unrest. In order to create unrest. These are the quotes from the actual government manifesto. In a spectacular display of bureaucratic ledger domain. Always love that word. This process is apparently defined as altering adversary perception. The new leak also reveals that CSEC uses honeypot or watering hole techniques in service of generating deceptive cyber activity. Though no greater detail is given on that point, the principle is one of presenting a tempting online target and attempting to gain advantage from the actors attracted to it. Additionally, the leaked information discloses CSEC. God, that's hard to say without sounding like you're saying sex, see? CSEC's cooperation with the NSA in service of an active computer network access and exploitation on a variety of foreign intelligence targets, including CT, That's counterterrorism, by the way. Middle East, North Africa, Europe, and Mexico. Responding to the site's inquiries, a spokesperson for the CSEC. Gosh darn it. Stated the documents in question do not necessarily reflect current CSE practices or programs. Not necessarily. So maybe we are, maybe we're not. We're not going to tell you. And continued in, quote, moving from ideas or concepts to planning and implementation, we examine proposals closely, don't we all, to ensure that they comply with the law and internal policies and that they ultimately lead to effective and efficient ways to protect Canada and Canadians against threats like clowns such as him in office. A leaked NSA briefing paper cited by Intercept / CBC. Ooh, I don't know if the CBC wants to get in bed with Intercept if they still want to get federal funding from this blue turd. Anyway, outlines the very close relationship that the CSE maintains with the, take a guess, United States National Security Agency, the NSA. CSEC offers resources for advanced collection, processing, and analysis and has opened covert sites at the request of the NSA, not at the request against doing that of the Canadian people who are supposedly the people that are, you know, in charge of this thing. If you still believe that kind of stuff, wherever your country is, you're nuts. CSEC shares with NSA their unique geographic access to areas unavailable in the U.S., i.e. their sites in the PRC, and provides cryptographic products, cryptanalysis, technology, and software. CSEC has increased its investment in R&D projects of mutual interest. Well, of course they have. Of course they've increased their investment in R&D projects of mutual interest because they have the inside interest. There's nothing above board about these people. It's amazing. Anyway, that's Harper's Canada. And you know what else is going on in Harper's Canada? People are losing their jobs in the oil patch. Ugh. Yep. The one that he was pumping so hard to keep it going for so long. It looks like it's tanking, and they're actually throwing people out that don't even have ways to get back to their own residence or anywhere else. Just get out of here and send them out. It's just such a lovely way to go. It's almost like the military, only, you know, they weren't killing anybody beforehand. It's really bad. They're just sending these guys out. And so the plan of the economic, wonder powerhouse that Canada was going to be under this economic stalwart genius Harper is not really panning out at all, because what's oil at now? $50? It doesn't work unless it's at 100, 150. So that's a bit of a problem with those guys, I guess. But anyway, there are other problems with oil. More spillage. Gosh. Yep, the Murphy Oil, that company, reports a leak of up to 17,000 barrels in northern Alberta. I say this because a lot of times we don't think about the oil unless it's a giant thing like the Gulf Horizon explosion or something, but it's happening so very often. Murphy Oil says up to 17,000 barrels of petroleum product may have spilled at its Seal heavy oil site in northern Alberta, says here on the mainstream press. globalnews.ca. It says the spill occurred over an extended period of time, but it's still assessing how big it is and how long it lasted. See, they don't even know. Like, these are the people in charge of doing it. They did it. They're responsible for it. Anyway, it's time for us to go and visit our interviewee. Now, this is a great guy. He's got a wide-ranging book called Wiki versus NWO. I'm sure you're going to love it. And he does get into a lot of different topics, so we don't have one particular strict focus as much as we usually do on the show tonight or today. But that's okay. We're just kicking back with Grant Elder. So I think we start off, I'm asking him about what it's like to start writing your first book, being such a large book. So now let's go to our interview. As I understand it, this is a 900-and-something page book. How many pages is it, Grant?
976 pages.
That's a number that's going to stick in your mind forever?
Yeah, it's a brick. I sell it by the pound, actually.
You couldn't quite make 1,000 pages out of it, huh?
You know what? I didn't even try to make 1,000.
No, that's not the thing, though. It's not quantity. It's quality. And, of course, so this is your first book you've ever written. That's impressive to kick it off with a 972-page book. But tell us what kinds of things were happening with you and your awarenesses that would even take you to a place where you might want to write a book of this topic.
Well, I'm a management consultant, right? So I've got an undergraduate degree in political science, and I've got my certified management accountant. So I've got two university degrees under my belt. And I was in heavy industry consulting, and when 9/11 happened, I was actually director of finance at Air Transat, probably a company you've heard of. So pretty high level. And when the planes hit the towers, we knew exactly what was going on. And my life was impacted greatly. I mean, the next 30 days, I had to figure out how to shred anywhere from 20, 25, 30% of the people out of the business and reduce costs. And we were basically sleeping at the airport in Maribel at the time.
So you said you knew that what was going on the day. You mean about your management company and what you guys were going to do?
Yeah. I mean, okay. I was an employee at that point of the company. And so we went through the whole 9/11 thing. I bought everything hook, line, and sinker. You know, the government's told us we're being attacked by terrorists the whole bit. And after that, I left that company. I went down to the U.S. to work for a while, back to management consulting. And this is where you have heavy industry and we're trying to teach them how to organize large groups of people with diverse businesses and stuff and bring it all together and make it happen.
And that company you were working with on the day of 9/11, the management consultant, that where was that? Was that in New York?
No, that was in Mirabel. That was Air Transat.
It's Mirabel Airport in Montreal, right?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So Air Transat was at that time, the third largest carrier in Canada in the charter industry. It was in the top one or two. So, you know, wide-body jets, and we're basically in the thick of it because in the airline industry, everybody's affected quite a bit more than most other industries when that happened. So at that point, I went back to management consulting down in the U.S., and I've toured a lot of the states over the 15 years of consulting, or 20 years now, but over 10 years spent in the United States going around. And the whole time, I was always thinking to myself, we turn these businesses around. And I look at my government and, now 47 years of age, and I've never seen them do anything really for me other than cause me pain and grief. And the whole time I had in the back of my mind the fact that, you know, why aren't we doing these basic things with their government? I mean, we should be seeing what we're doing in business. We should be seeing used and applied to government. I know government's usually 20 years behind, but now to me, it's looking like we're a couple hundred years behind. And I was thinking to myself, well, nobody's ever going to read a book about how to turn government around and the practical basic things we should be seeing as a group of people. And then at one point I was down in New York, we're doing steel plants, and we got an email, and it was the Loose Change documentary about how 9/11 was an inside job.
Right, that's the Dylan Avery film?
Yeah.
Was it Loose Change 1 or 2 or 5 or 7 or 8?
It was one at that point. It was actually just a PowerPoint they had put together, and it was sent out on the wire, you know.
And how fresh after 9/11 was this again that you saw this?
Well, this was the thing. We were a year and a half later, or actually, no, I guess it was a year later, exactly. I finished up at Air Transat. We went right down there. And my wife came home because she happened to go downtown to Manhattan on the anniversary. I think it was the first anniversary. And she came home and she said, Grant, you won't believe this. There are people demonstrating downtown. 9/11 is an inside job. And look at these pamphlets and look at the facts on here. And let's turn on the news. We're going to see this. So we turn on the TV and we're thinking we're going to see something. I mean, you know, there's an abortion bombing or something, or even a demonstration, and it's on the news. And she thought, you know, this will definitely be on the news. So we turn it on and nothing. Absolutely blank, nothing. And she was, you know, pretty struck by that. And, you know, I wasn't there, but I could tell by her reaction that,
nothing
was covered. All these people in black and white 9/11 truth t-shirts, downtown New York, you know, a huge demonstration with the pamphlets being distributed all over the place. And there's nothing on the news. And she's going, this can't be, this is impossible. Right.
Right.
So that's, you know, was our first little hint that there was something not right in Dodge, you know. So we came home, you know, I go back, I work quite a bit, and you get back to your daily life and back into the matrix, I guess. And then about 5 years later, I'm in between gigs. So I have some free time, and I watch a documentary called In Plain Sight. And this was a radio announcer.
Yeah, that's Dave Von Cleef or something, or?
Yeah, the radio host on the United States put this together.
This is the guy that said no planes, right? No planes flew or something.
No, he didn't have that one. He just said that there was something odd about the planes. And then, that documentary, I just pulled one out after another because I was off. And then down the rabbit hole, you pull on that thread, and well, off you go, right?
I agree. I pulled on that thread myself. I was at it on September 11th, actually. I was off work as well, and I went downstairs and started following things. And, you know, the thing that I noticed that really struck me as odd, because I wasn't seeing a lack of protest coverage on TV like your wife noticed, but what I noticed was the amount of reports changing and flicking around and that kind of thing, and points of view of scattering. But this is a very strange one. The fact that the pile was burning in New York right into well into December.
Yeah. Yeah,
to me, and that was on the news. They were saying, well, the smoke's still coming out from this fire that can't possibly hold smoke for 3 months. But anyway, and people were fine with that. So, you know, yeah, there's a lot of there are a lot of unturned stones in there. But yeah, I just wanted to give you a little taste of the same kind of something's not right here. But anyway, go ahead.
Exactly. Yeah. So as I pulled on that thread, and you pull one after the other, I decided to write the book on that, because I thought to myself, here's content. Here's first of all, it's a burning platform. People don't change unless they have a reason to change. And I'm thinking, well, if this isn't going to be a reason to change, when you realize how the banking system works, how what happened with 9/11, and everything they're hiding from us, if you can't make that a reason to change, you'll never find any. And I thought this would at least make the content of how to reorganize government more interesting, maybe palatable to some people who would never even broach it otherwise.
Right.
You know what I mean? Because mm-hmm. One of the things I find, you know, you talk about the questions that, you know, we should be asking and so forth. And one of them is, why don't people do something? And I think that the answer is that people don't know what to do. I'm meeting a lot of people who are awake, but they really just, they got plugged back in because they really don't know how things can be different.
Well, you're running along on a bogus little system that as you called it, the Matrix earlier. And so that's a plan, at least. You might not like it. It might not help you, but you can follow it. It's easy to understand. But if
exactly.
You literally have your own freedom, a lot of people, I think, fight to not have it because they'd rather have a plan. They don't know what to do with their own freedom.
Yeah. And it's, you know, if it's comfortable, it's okay. I'm not free, but I'm comfortable. There's a lot of that going on too, right?
Right.
So, you know, I try and describe a world that could be vastly different and, you know, a lot more positive, and try to begin to show people the opportunities lost. Because, like, when you don't know what you don't have, you know, you don't miss it. But if you start showing someone, listen, you know, you work all the time, you work until July, August for the government, and then you start making money. Imagine if you had all that time to yourself beforehand. Well, guess what? That's actually what you're losing out in your life right now because of the system.
Yeah.
You know,
the system, the system that puts you in a place where you will die if you don't earn those little bits of paper we're all supposed to chase after. It just doesn't seem all that natural.
No.
But it is natural that at times we have to step away, and this is one of those times. You're listening to Conspiracy Queries with Alan Park. We're on Sirius XM. We'll be right back with Grant Elder and his book, Wiki versus NWO. We'll get into more of that in a couple of seconds. Stick around. We are back with Grant Elder. He was just explaining how a man winds up having enough existential crisis in his life to need to write a 972-page book over 7 years. And so far, so good. You everything was awry and askew, and then you decided that the system as it is not good enough. But you, and like others waking up, don't really know what to do outside of a system or alongside of a system or instead of a system. So that's where you left us.
Yeah, so from my perspective, there's a lot of things that can change easily. Pragmatic stuff, you know, it's not airy fairy stuff. It's very what we do with large organizations. I mean, you sit back on every day and you look, and you know, people are playing with their iPhone or whatever. When you take a solid look at it and you realize that tens of thousands of people working in collaboration to come up with these high pieces of technology, you realize our capabilities are absolutely monumental. And then you look at your government where, you know, every time there's an election, you can wind back. We have an election here coming in October in Canada. And this is like this all over the Western world. You can roll back to the election coverage of 1974. And I guarantee you 80% of the conversation on that media coverage will be exactly at the debate, exactly the same.
Oh, should we have abortion or not? And, yeah. You know,
I'm going to do this for the economy, and I'm for jobs.
Sure.
And, you know, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes. They all say the same things. So...
Yeah, so no evolution on that part.
Let's spend a bit of time on the title of your book. Now, to you, what is NWO and what is Wiki and why are they versus? What does that mean?
Well, the New World Order is basically, if you go on YouTube and take a look, you're going to find every president talking about it. So there's one thing, what they're saying, they're mentioning, you know, Tony Blair, George Bush, both Bushes talk about the New World Order, especially senior, you know, Henry Kissinger, and these guys are all talking about the establishment of a New World Order. And once you realize that these are bad people, you have to start asking yourself, well, what do they mean when they're saying New World Order? And when you start researching it, you realize that it's really a great system if you're an international banker. And if you're anybody else but, well, you're basically cattle, and your property, and they can do with property whatever the heck they want. And you know, it comes back to the book 1984. It's a totalitarian society where they will decide as bankers what resources need to be kept to their best benefit. And if you're not on their list, guess what? You're not going to be there.
Mm.
So right. That's the New World Order. And Wiki stands for quick collaboration. You saw the rise of, for example, Wikipedia,
right,
where people collaborating could generate knowledge and content at such a rate where an established, you know, couple hundred year old Encyclopedia Britannica just got wiped out overnight. And it shows you the power of collaboration. So Wiki stands for, you know, quick collaboration. And that's the emphasis is the versus. It's collaboration versus domination is the ultimate theme of the book.
Domination or collaboration is basically, it could have been that title, but this is more to the point of what needs to be done versus who's already doing it.
Exactly. Hmm. Yeah.
Did you have a proofreader or someone else that was, you know, reading along whatever it is you were writing in this book? Was that a bit of a surprise for them, or what did they?
Yeah. So the girl I got to do the first round of it, it's Michelle Booth. She'd already had encounters with the government. This is a girl who showed up at a protest, a logging protest, didn't even arrive. She hadn't even put down her bag, and there was a mass arrest, and she was picked up. And, like, she ended up wearing an ankle bracelet. So she's felt the brunt of the system on many occasions. So she is aware of quite a bit, and she's actually doing her master's in journalism right now, and she's doing it on UFOs. And you can imagine how well that's going over in a university setting.
UFOs, well, yeah, I guess it would depend on the crazy corduroy jacket wearing left wing prof, but
that's right.
It's probably not going over very well, I would imagine.
She's having a tough time. So she did the first round and, you know, challenged some of the concepts and stuff in the book. And then I had some family and friends and so forth, you know. And that was the first round. Then the second round was just a final clean edit from the publishing company in Victoria, BC. Freedom Press. Yeah.
That's great. And where can we get this? Is this an Amazon thing, or are you in stores, or where else can we find
it? It's available on Amazon.com, Amazon.ca. It's cheaper on .com for sure. And, you know, it's at the University, McGill University bookstore. It's the hard copy is obviously expensive. I think the book on .com is $68. In the U.S. it's $51. You know, it's a lot of pages, but it's a lot of books in one, right? I mean, it's written in two parts. It's written, part one is two-thirds of the book is getting people to understand the current situation. So here's the world in which we actually live with what we know. And then part two being one-third is here's what we know in business and how we learn to collaborate and the tools and mechanisms we put in place from a management perspective and from a technology perspective. If we leverage that, here's what the solution can begin to look like.
But when we say what we know, I mean, there are a lot of facts out there that people choose to not know and then just operate their own lives as if those facts don't exist because they don't want them to.
Yeah. And you know what? That's exactly one of the issues I've had in talking to people with anybody. So, you know, here I've got a couple, you know, university degrees. My brother's a surgeon. You know, my father's an engineer. I'm surrounded by professionals. And if you talk about a specific point and you're trying to talk about the New World Order, people turn off because it's too big of a leap.
Sure.
And if you offer any of these things up like a piecemeal at a time, like you talk about banking or you talk about chemtrails or UFOs or whatever, you know, they can discredit. And that's why I put it all together in one book to say, listen, this is not one fact. Here's a body of knowledge. Here's a new paradigm, a new way of looking at the world. And you can see that every single piece fits together like this magical puzzle to paint a picture of, you know, what's running your life. Because I found like if you focus on one, well, you know, they can ignore it or they'll just walk away and you'll go back to sleep. But once you hit them with a whole bunch of it, and then, you know, I've had people who didn't believe any of it. And as they move through the book, you know, they'd come up for dinner and they'd start crying.
Let's touch on some of the chapters. Now, I want to kick this off by saying that Grant has made the first chapter as a free download. Is that right?
Yeah.
Is that still active? Because I see that up from last year. Is that still going on? You can get the first chapter?
Yep, absolutely.
So you're like a heroin dealer. Here, have a first bit for free.
Yeah, and if it makes you cry, you might not come back for
a box of Kleenex. Okay, I just want to spend a bit of time with you on each one of, not each one, but some of these chapters and topics that you handle, because of course we can't go through everything, but there are a lot of interesting things in here and that you reference in the book that aren't free and they have to buy the book. But you're going to tell us a little bit of the beans anyway, okay?
Sure.
Give me your understanding of this man named Ted Gunderson, because I've read so many different things about him on both sides of the issue, and personally, my own self, I've just gone, okay, I don't know what's up with that guy, and I can't figure it out, and I don't believe he's alive anymore, so I'll get to him later, and, you know, I will. He's a fascinating character, former FBI chief in the States, but what is your take on him? What did you learn about him, and how were you, what's the basic take on that chapter in your book?
Well, he's just, chapter, I got to remember now, there's 14 chapters within the New World Order.
Well, the heading on the website, it says, former FBI Chief Ted Gunderson says chemtrail death dumps must be stopped.
Yeah.
But Ted Gunderson has been on the revelatory side of what's wrong with government so many times that some people say, oh, he's on their side. He's a shill. He's a pawn. He's a, you know, one of those guys, sort of an insider who is acting like he's you know what I mean? Like a rat, a weasel for the New World Order itself. But everything he says is against the New World Order.
I know. So I don't really care. Like if he's willing to get out and say, by the way, the chemtrails are real, and put his face online and say so with his credentials behind it.
Yeah.
I really don't care about the rest of it. I'll use it.
And he calls them chemtrail death dumps because obviously they're putting in toxic. Did you get into in your book what those toxic things are and what any kind of real plan is for why they're doing that?
You know what? That's a good one, because at the end of the day, in my research and looking at it, I wasn't certain. And I don't say I'm certain. All I know is it's wrong and you haven't been consulted. And in a free and open society, shouldn't you be at least be aware or know that your government is doing this? I mean, and you know, you have to understand, the first time I got an email from a friend telling me, by the way, they're spraying us with chemicals, I was like, well, listen, I've been in the airline industry, I've been in aircraft maintenance, you know, I don't believe this for one second. And 2 years later, I'm working down in California, and I'm on my way to work, and I see the crisscrossing in the skies like I've never seen. And having been in the airline industry, I know one thing for certain, is that most aircraft in North America are within 86% to 88% on their on-time performance, and all of their flights are pre-scheduled. So you don't expect huge changes on the patterns on a Monday morning when you're living close to an airport. And that's when it really struck me. And my wife and I would sit out at night in California. We couldn't believe these things just spreading this coating. And then when we got home from California, we're in St. Sever, Northern Quebec. I didn't think I'd see them up here. And then there we are in the car, and I'm watching four flights in parallel heading in the wrong direction for this location. And that's when I really thought, okay, this chemtrail thing is absolutely true. And then I dug into it. And obviously you've got a lot of people, especially in California, who've done, you know, water sampling. They know there's the aluminum in the water content that's way too high in the soil now. They've traced to where it's coming from the skies. You now have pilots coming forward. You have military coming forward. Some are saying it's for economic benefits. Some are saying it's, you know, to struggle and pull the water down quicker in one continent versus another.
I've heard to protect us against global warming too and reflect the sun back out into space because it's too hot here. I've heard that.
Yeah, and my gut tells me that, you know, that could be true, and they want to cool the planet faster than warm it. I don't believe in global warming being man-made, to be honest with you. That's one where I differ from a lot of people. And I say to myself, okay, so here they can hide UFOs, you know, they can hide 9/11, they hide the banking. And when I started digging into global warming, you know, because I remember in the early 2000s, they said, oh, by 2006, you're really going to feel. You know, in the early 2000s, we were hearing about global warming being a disaster, and it was going to bring all this pain and hardship within 5 years. And 2005, 2006 roll around, then you got Al Gore coming with his movie after that, saying, okay, now it's really it. And then by 2010, you people are really going to feel it and see it. And, you know, Lake Superior just froze over for the first time in 80 years, you know. So,
well, this is the year, according to The Inconvenient Truth of 2007, which won the Oscar. Let's not forget. It actually said that I think right now, I'm not 100% certain, but here we are at 2015. I don't believe there's any ice up in the Arctic right now, according to that movie.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. That's right.
But then again, there is ice in the Arctic, according to reality. So, yeah.
And you know what, Alan? The planet could be warming slightly at a certain rate. You know, my dad, we talk about the glaciers in certain parts that have pulled back. But is it man-made was the question, right? And the first thing I know is that when somebody lies to me, I tend to not believe the rest of what they're saying. And when I started looking into it, and you see Al Gore go up the scissor lift and show the exponential growth in CO2 in the atmosphere.
Yeah,
I remembered as a child, maybe my teens, watching this documentary where the scientist was injecting CO2 into an aquarium and showing how big the fish were getting, because he was saying that, you know, the reason the dinosaurs grew so big was because of the high CO2 content in the atmosphere of the Earth at that point. And he says when we're looking to find out why dinosaurs grew so big, we're looking at environmental factors. And he says the CO2 was a big contributor.
Wow, so that might gee whiz. Have you ever thought about those giant people, those large archaeological records of people that were not as big as dinosaurs, but much bigger than we are?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, they were back then too. That was in that higher CO2 kind of times as well.
Yeah, and then when you backtrack the CO2 levels, you realize that Al Gore left out. You know, just if he'd just gone, another 100,000 years to the left of his graph, you would have seen the bathtub. You would have seen the CO2 spike hugely way up there. Yeah. But he omitted that information. When somebody omits information when they're presenting a case to me, I mean, at work, they're gone. I see you. You committed fraud, right?
Yeah, it's the same as lying, lie by omission. But listen, let's just take it for a second here. You're clearly, you don't believe so you do believe in global warming. But or climate change, but not necessarily that it's caused by whatever man is doing. Is that right?
Exactly. Because then when you dig into it and you realize that this whole notion of fossil fuel at the very base of it is a lie. I mean, the Russians dug down deep into the mantle to show that, by the way, there were no dinosaurs down here and we're still tapping into the oil. And they did this in the 1950s when Rockefeller Foundation was pushing the whole fossil fuel thing. But they, of course, they never got listened to. And this lie has gone on that oil comes from fossil fuels. Then you start digging into it and you realize, well, you know what? There's methane gases on other planets. And we have astrophysicists who now understand that there's a CO2 cycle on our planets that works with the sun and it's always exchanging. And some have even hypothesized that it's actually a bacteria deep down that's capable of breaking materials down and creating petroleum. And that's why in some cases we've had wells come back, probably not at the rate where we're emptying them. But, you know, this is a normal thing. So the whole dinosaur thing.
But getting back to the dinosaurs, though, they were huge, you say, because the CO2 just does that to the physiology of the biological unit. It just gets gigantic.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah, well, that's what the guy was doing. He's punching CO2 into an aquarium to test and grow the fish bigger. So this was, you know, the university professor doing research on why the dinosaurs grew big. I just remembered that. And then I thought to myself, well, here's Al Gore. So then you start tracing that down. You realize his data false. Well, why would I believe the rest of what he's saying?
Well, here's the thing about Al Gore. Just for 2 seconds, Grant, just entertain this notion. Let's say it is man-made global warming, as Al Gore claims. Just for a second, okay? An intellectual exercise. I'm not trying to change your mind. But Al Gore is saying it's a man-made thing and it's a problem. We've got to stop it and everything. And here's a guy making this movement who has apparently, from what I've researched, the largest private home footprint in his estate, in the entire state. So just for like 10 minutes at a time, I do believe that global warming is caused by man. And how weird is it that the icon of this entire movement has a bigger global warming footprint than almost everybody else in Tennessee?
Yeah.
Oh, God. So, but then he doesn't concern himself with that, probably because he knows, if the truth is what you're saying, he knows that his gigantic footprint's not really a problem.
Well, he knows they have control of the media, and just as they had the monetary system, they know it's going to crash at some point, and they're going to replace it with something. They're going to have chaos, and they're going to replace it with their order. And their order is a carbon tax trading system. You know, the mechanisms are being in place to create this credit system based on carbon trading. And these guys are going to be at the forefront, and they're all been promised they're going to make it rich. I'm sure of that one.
Right. Wow.
You know, that's it. Your future economic systems, you know, they're going to have it in their back pocket.
That's
ready
true.
To go when it's time.
One of the things we'll need to change if it really does get changed, is the I would say the monetary system. I mean, obviously, it's unsustainable, unfair, pretty much unnecessary as it now stands. So I wonder what you think about there was a recent court case.
Versus Bank of Canada.
Say it again.
Commer versus the Bank of Canada.
C-O-M-E-R. Oh, one more time. One more time. Who was the respondent again? The Bank of Canada, right. I know, because I was watching the local news at 6 o'clock last night, and they were talking all about it. No, they didn't say anything about it, actually. It's not in the news. Tell us about that. Tell us about what happened with Commer versus the Bank of Canada.
Well, it's funny, Alan, because I was at the Bill C-51 rally last weekend giving a speech. And I couldn't remember. I was going, there's a case against the Bank of Canada. And a half a dozen people up front right away said, Commer versus Bank of Canada. Everybody knew what it was about.
Yeah.
So basically, my understanding is in 1974, when Trudeau had the, you know, when he brought us into the G8, part of that deal was to bring us under the international banking system. At that point, Canada had $3 billion worth of debt. Now, you have to understand, Canada at this point, we'd drilled through the Rockies, laid rail from coast to coast. St. Lawrence Seaway Canal System was constructed. Most of the buildings, everything in the country was constructed. Your schools were constructed. Everything was done. The bridges. I mean, the country had gone a long way up until 1974, and you look at most of the infrastructure, the power plants, everything was there. And we finished World War II. We had one of the biggest navies on the planet. For such a small group of people, it's amazing it was achieved. We finished off with $3 billion worth of debt. 1974 rolls around. We joined the GA. We joined the International Banking Consortium. And all of a sudden, the Bank of Canada, instead of creating currency for Canadian people in the best interest and for the public service of Canadians.
Which was how they built the rail from end to end and put all those structures together and Tommy Douglas's health care and all those things, right? I mean, that's how they did that, with a much lower interest rate.
Absolutely. Okay. So then after that, they said, oh, no way. As a part of the G8 and the G groups, you're going to now have the nice benefit of dealing with international banks. And by the way, they're going to handle the monetary system because this is going to help stabilize the world. And they, you know, I'm sure they coded it very well for Mr. Trudeau, who then believed in a just society and thought he was doing a good thing for the globe at that time. And duped like many people, I'm sure he just signed on. And our debt has gone in the last few decades up to $617 billion just at the federal level. And, you know, the interest payments are absolutely phenomenal. So now we are a debt nation, and the Bank of Canada has not been doing its job. So Commer is basically against the Bank of Canada. It's a case where they're saying, hey, you're going to get back and do your job as it was written in the Constitution, and it's written in your charter, Bank of Canada. You're supposed to be doing the money printing, because today these guys offshore, these bankers, these Rockefeller, Rothschild banks just say, listen, we're going to lend you another $100 billion this year, and you're going to start paying us back with 6% interest. And in the meantime, they never had the that $100 billion. The Bank of Canada prints it, and then we just get held up for the liability on the interest. It's absolutely phenomenal.
And who went along with this?
Not the Canadian people. They never even knew. Just like the Americans, the British, and every other Western nation never knew it was happening.
Yeah. God. Unbelievable. Well, listen, we're going to step away for a second. We're with Grant Elder, and he's got a great book. And it's fun because he's all over the place with the topics that he has putting together and into a big soup that we need to throw out the window and invent something else. So we need to understand what the problems are before we can fix them. And so that's what Grant is doing. And we'll be right back on Conspiracy Queries with Alan Park. Stick around. All right, that break is over, and we're back with Grant. And, the Bank of Canada, we were still discussing. So where did we leave that? They've reversed everything. They put us into a situation where we're now somehow, for some strange reason, in a high-interest position and borrowing from different banks that aren't the Bank of Canada.
Yeah, amazing, isn't it?
So that's what the lawsuit was about for Calmer?
Yeah, well, it's still in court right now, right? It's not settled.
Okay.
And my guess is, unless the people were to wake up, it will be settled in the darkness in the back room somewhere at some point and just disappear.
And how might that go if it, you know, they'll just rule against? What would they say? They say, well, okay, you guys win, but we're not going to talk about this? Or how? Yeah. Or they'll just rule against it anyway, even though it's legitimate?
They'll just rule against it and let them keep fighting. I mean, that's the way it's happened down in the United States. In the United States, you have the Federal Reserve, which obviously every person on the planet thinks is a federal institution. Well, it's not. It's a private banking cartel, and it's been admitted on TV. It's admitted in their documents. But they're allowed to give themselves the name Federal Reserve. It's absolutely fantastic when you think about what they got away with. And I guess that was in about 1913. And there have been many American presidents, or not presidents, sorry, but congressmen who tried to fight that institution because it's the same thing as what our Bank of Canada is doing. Yeah. You had Ron Paul, the congressman, you know, want to audit them, and he gets absolutely ridiculed in the media and just destroyed for it.
Yeah, for somebody putting up the notion of accountability and genuineness to see if everything's on the up and up.
Yeah, imagine.
With an audit with them, yeah.
We're the government, we'd like to audit our monetary system? Oh, no, that's just out of the question in a free society.
You might find something out. We don't want that. Yeah. You do cover a lot of interesting things on your website and related to the book, and you keep this connectivity with what's going on now with the outrageous things that you learned a long time ago and in a book. So you've kind of sandwiched things in a multimedia platform. I really like that. So what are we going to do to fix it, Grant?
Well, so there's two things in part two. I'm focusing on the management methodologies we use today for large corporations and technology. So I talk about the kid with the Lego. And so you can use both. We now have an opportunity in front of us where communication is changing. You know, a long time ago, you had the master talk to the slaves, and it was one-way communication. You know, then we got writing. And then, you know, the church tried to stop us from being able to read books. And, well, then the people fought, then we could read the books. And then we got the radio waves, and then everybody was broadcasting to each other on the planet. And then the government's locked down on that. Then we got television and did the same thing. So they're obviously going to try and lock down on the internet. But, you know, it would seem to me there's this trend where technology and the people's will to communicate en masse is ever increasing. And what we're seeing is that, you know, people are able to communicate in large levels. Look at you today. You know, for very low cost, you're able to communicate to a vast amount of people. And so that's changing the game in a big way. And this technology, we need to leverage it. So I, you know, the vision for me in the future is I should be able to take my phone, my smartphone, my computer, whatever, and be able to read up on any issue that is of concern to me and be able to participate in the dialogue. And we should have, you know, greater participation in terms of making decisions. So that there's a drawback to that because, you know, democracy does have its drawbacks if you have an electorate that isn't educated. And that's why, you know, the concepts of a republic, a law-based society is very important so that, you know, the majority can't just wipe out on a vote the minority, right?
Mm-hmm.
So these are all things that obviously are going to have to change from an educational perspective. But at the very beginning, it's like I would expect your leadership to do like we do in business. When we walk in, the first thing we want to know is where do you want to go in the future in the next 5-10 years and what do you do? And so I sit back and I look at the vision statements of our political parties. And they're absolute garbage. I mean, you can't figure anything out. And so when you sit back and you listen to their jargon, jobs, jobs, job, this, you realize that they're really not working for the people and they don't want to say it because then they're going to be held to it. And the only government that ever did that was, I think, Jean Chrétien's Liberal Party created the Red Book. And it was the first time I remember looking at what they were doing and thinking, this is the first time I've seen a party try and actually say what they're going to do. They're publicizing it so at the end of their term, they can be held accountable. It was an amazing thing. But the people weren't ready for it, and the media obviously didn't like it because, you know, changes the game. And, you know, not even 3/4 of the way through, they just lambasted them on every issue. And here the liberals were saying at the time, well, you know, conservatives aren't telling you what they're going to do. Nobody else is. We're the only ones. But that wasn't good enough.
Yeah.
So the first foray into that type of structure didn't do so well because the terrain wasn't prepared. But I think with technology, we can do a lot better than that.
Huh. Well, I hope you're right. That sounds good, but, you know, we do have to get the boot off of our throat to be able to get this going.
Yeah, and that's often where I'm looking at thinking, you know, is there any way that the current system can change from within. And, you know, I'd be curious as to what Paul Hellyer would have to say about that with his experience, because, you know, can we get a political party elected that would ever make this change? I don't believe so, because the media is so controlled and it's representative politics. And that's where I think software is going to play a big role in the future. You we're now seeing people organize, self-organize in these demonstrations. Now, obviously, like, you take the student demonstration in Montreal at the moment, you know, they've got social media to get organized. But obviously, the other side, the New World Order side, has their disinformation and they want to cause confusion. So they'll add in topics and then all of a sudden the massive group will spin out of control, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's a problem. But once the social organization starts getting some of these tools in place where they can have a logical way of determining their purpose and then a way of measuring it, I think we're going to eventually see a parallel process go up and that will take over the other one. It's like build, instead of tearing down your house and having no place to live, we're going to have to build something up in parallel at a municipal level, then a, you know, provincial, state level, and then at a federal level. That's the way I see it going.
Well,
we will at some point see a municipality that's going to be running in a completely democratic fashion where they're going to say, okay, this is what our municipality is about. This is our budget. These are our objectives. And people are going to be able to see on the net or on their phone exactly what's going on. They're going to communicate and exchange, and they're going to feel connected to the municipality. And then you're going to see municipalities link up, and it's going to look like the flower of life. It's going to be self-organization.
Okay, and how are we going to pull this off if folks are still flying around in planes that spray chemtrails and cops are killing people and all of that stuff?
Because not everybody's doing that. So, you know, when you look at the bad in the world, I don't think the most of the world's bad. We're talking about a lot of bad stuff. Like the first two-thirds of my book is bad stuff. But when you sit back and I look at, you know, thousands of people in the companies that I deal with, most of them are good. And it comes back to that question, why don't people participate and get engaged? Because they don't know what to do. Mm-hmm. I think the moment you give them a platform on which they can contribute, I think you're going to see it take hold, because it's what people actually want at the end of the day. But it has to be easy. And once we build that and get it going, that's basically, I wrote the book as a blueprint for this. You know, I'm not an author. I'm not planning on writing a bunch of future books. My next stage is working with like-minded people. We build these systems for government, for large corporations, and say, okay, let's get a bunch of us together. Now let's do a municipality. Let's give them the tools required to execute, and let's do a prototype. Let's get it done. And then we can replicate it as many times as fast as we want, because it's cheap as dirt. So it's going to be open source.
And you get this kind of information and message out on your website. Is that right?
The website, I've done part one. I've got all the data to help support part one. I'm just beginning to get part two, some videos. Oh. Part two is really in the book right now, and I've got to spend the next couple months getting low. Because it's not that it's technical, but it is in the book. It's dry material, so I got to get some more videos up to help get people over. Like when we're talking about organizational structure, you know, like the lessons learned in business and how they would apply to government. When we're talking about leadership selection, well, you know, we shouldn't be voting for Justin Trudeau, you know, because he's the only choice out of three or four. We should have a system in place where the most intelligent people in society are contributing, and other people around them are saying, this is a great contribution. You can see the history of that person's contribution. You can drill into it, and then you can go through a whole bunch of people, maybe 100 people, and they would just rank up.
Right.
And, you know, there's no reason we can't do that today. The technology is available.
Well, that is true. It's proliferating like crazy, and that is an interesting angle. So I hope that it's going well for you book sales-wise, and that people do understand these things. And I could tell you are a new author, because about 2 minutes ago you said, you quoted, I could almost quote you, you said, yeah, the first two-thirds of my book, really bad. And then no other author says that. So if you do some more interviews and anything like that, do not repeat that phrase. I know it's just out of context. I'm just joking. But anyway, it's a fascinating read. I've read the first chapter, and I'm looking forward to the rest. So I will be shopping at Amazon, where you can get it. Unless I decide to get I don't know if I want the 972 page thing right now. But I might get that one too. Who knows? I'll get one of them.
We'll get my wife to send you a copy.
Oh, great. Okay. Well, hear that, folks? Thanks for listening. Grant's wife is going to send y'all a copy of. Up there. Did I get that wrong? Oh, you're going to send me a copy. Okay.
I'll send you a copy, Alan.
Okay, that's reasonable. That's reasonable. I was going to say, here's an author who says first two-thirds of his book is bad, and he's giving it away for nothing to everybody. This guy is not going to write another book, that's for sure. I'm just having fun with you, Grant, because I like that there's a nice little positive spin at the end of your message. A lot of the folks on our show can't possibly do that. So I appreciate that you did.
Cool. Yeah. I think we got to be positive. It's the only way forward.
Well, I don't know about that. That's just a joke, too. That's a joke also. All right. I'm losing it now because I'm thinking about this stuff, and I'm just very happy to come across you, and thanks for contacting the show, and I hope you're happy with the way things went today.
I really appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to Conspiracy Queries with Alan Park. Please offer comments or complaints by emailing conspiracyqueries@gmail.com or on Twitter @con_queries or at our website, conspiracyqueries.com. Thanks for listening.